You know, who knows? Maybe this movie is pulling ahead of Maxine the more I think about Maxine.
Amazing.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
Nah, either they can't hear us or they don't understand.
Son of a bitch, I'm sick of these dolphins.
Hello, everybody. It is Wreckatopia, episode 123. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Idly ho, Zizzerinos.
There you go. Yeah, indeed. Yes, today's big recommend is going to be Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. This is Aaron's turn, his second turn at the movies that have great critical acclaim or have been recommended to him, and he has never liked. Does he like it by the end of this episode? Stay tuned. Would like to welcome chat on a Thursday. No, we've been doing this crazy Thursday schedule. We will be back to Tuesday, I think, next week. We will be doing that, and we're going to continue the series too for a while. We got to talk about that with you, Aaron, how long we want to keep on doing this at some point. But we're going to do it next week as well, and I imagine the following week to make everything even, and then we'll see where we're at. But do you want to start us off with any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Yes, I do, in fact. I would like to recommend to Smalley a TV show called Presumed Innocent. In fact, it is probably more than a small recommend. I'm really, really liking it. Jake Gyllenhaal steps into the Harrison Ford role from the movie. If you've seen the movie, you know this is a twisty thriller, murder mystery kind of movie. I only recently saw the original for the first time, probably within the last year, and really dug it. I thought it was really well structured, kept me in it, found the story turns to be interesting, and the reveals to be fun. So I enjoyed the movie, came into this just, you know, because I'd heard good things about it. I waited until there were whatever there are now. I started watching it last week, so like five or six episodes out. Kind of binge them all, and man, this is really well done. The acting is incredible. And beyond the performances, there is this sense that you aren't locked into necessarily the same plot as the movie. The creators have said, we're not saying for sure whether the ending to this is the same as what happens in the movie. And so they've added an element of suspense to it. Now, it may be the same as the movie, may end up the same, but them just saying that has allowed me to kind of feel some of the suspense about what is happening. What are the clues leading to? I highly recommend it on the production value and performances alone, if not the fun murder mystery whodunit kind of aspect to everything. Chris, have you seen any of this?
I have not seen it. I actually am very interested in it because I love the movie. And I guess the book, I haven't read the book on this, but the movie is fantastic. And like you said, it's got one of those great all time twists to it and everything. I will be interested to see if they change this at all too. I guess you can come up with a different satisfying conclusion to it. From the book, but who knows? But yeah, I love the movie. I love Raul Julia in that movie, who plays his defense attorney. Mm-hmm. It's the type of movie that you don't see anymore. You don't see these adult courtroom drama type thrillers anymore. Those things get relegated to, you know, Netflix and Amazon these days and everything, because, you know, they can't depend on the olds to come out to the theater anymore. So
speaking of which, this is on Apple TV Plus, if you do want to check it out. I should mention a couple other things. Speaking of courtrooms, it is David E. Kelly, that's doing this. So it's somebody who definitely knows their way around a courtroom drama in courtroom scenes. And then I also wanted to give specific mention to the other amazing performances, specifically Ruth Negga, who is astonishing in this. And then you mentioned the Raul Julia role. Bill Camp is doing that. And he is so good in this. And then Peter Sarsgaard is the prosecuting attorney, Tommy Molto, and just chewing scenery as well. So I'm digging all these performances, and it's been a really fun show. So highly recommend it.
All right. I watched a movie last week that I had not seen, had never seen before. It was kind of an award season movie. Tail end of the time where I started getting into movies and everything, even though I was working at a movie theater at the time, but 6 Degrees of Separation is what I ended up watching. And I think this may have gotten on my radar because of the recent death of Donald Sutherland. But this is a role, by the way, you will never, ever see Will Smith do again.
I think that's unfortunate. That's so sad. Yeah.
He is so caught up on his image after Independence Day that he started turning down roles that would have been really interesting for him to do, and he always wanted to keep that squeaky clean image until he slapped Chris Rock on stage. But yeah, this is kind of a satire on white liberal elites in New York. This couple is trying to sell a painting. They have to get somebody to help them buy the painting so that they can then profit on the painting. And they're getting Ian McKellen in a role back then. They are telling this story about how this young black man came up to their door asking for some help, and they brought him in, and they started having this big conversation with him and saying that, you know, he knew their children, he's gone to school with them and all that. I think the thing is that he's claiming that he got mugged outside and he just needs to call somebody and all that. And then we find out through this conversation that he is the son of Sidney Poitier and that he needs to get back tomorrow to see him and everything. So they're having these great, highly intellectual conversations with each other. Meanwhile, the story goes back and forth between Donald Sutherland and Stockard Channing telling their friends about this incident that they had, and then finding out that this kid that came into their house was completely had some secrets maybe that they weren't quite prepared for, including the fact that he's gay and that he'd invited a gay lover over while he was spending the night, and that was a big to do and everything. Will Smith, by the way, you wouldn't, like I said, never will see this ever again. So the friends end up talking to their friends, and they find out that he has hit up everybody in their circle, and that strangely nothing has been stolen. Nothing is out of the ordinary, except that he came and he lied about who he was and all this other stuff. So like that's the main crux. What is he after? What is the main thing that he's going after here? This movie's very good. I was surprised that I had not seen it for all this long, but yeah, very much enjoyed this.
It has been too long since I've seen it for me to have anything really substantive to say about it, but I do remember really, really enjoying it. And you know, same as you, because I saw it, I'm sure, after Independence Day, probably after Men in Black, you know, and and just looking back and going, oh man, where's this like path for Will Smith? Like where's the sliding door that leads to, you know, Will Smith taking more roles like this? And it's not like he doesn't do more dramatic roles. It's just that they're always the same kind of, you know, roles. And he just doesn't take the risks that you see some actors are willing to take. And I just, you know, I'd love to see him stretch, but.
And considering this was right after Fresh Prince too, like, he looked like he was just on that trajectory of having that kind of a career. But that's what happens when you get into a huge movie like Independence Day, and like people kind of expect a certain thing out of you after that.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Let's see. For my other small recommend, I am going to go with a movie I saw that I cannot find. Oh, there it is. I saw Beverly Hills Cop Axe Left. Now, Chris, you mentioned this briefly during talking about Kevin Bacon being in Maxine and Axel F the same weekend. And I got the sense that you didn't enjoy it all that much. Maybe I'm wrong. And that's fine.
I think I liked it okay. I'm not as over the moon about it as some people are yet.
I'm not quite over the moon, but boy, did I have a good time with this movie. A much better time than certainly I was expecting to have with this movie. And I think there is something about, like, I just never thought Eddie Murphy could recapture the absolute spark and explosion that he was in these movies when he came out. And to a degree, that is true. He is not exactly the same. He's definitely a more aged version of that character, but he is that character in this movie. He got a lot of that spark back for this. And I think if I'm going to say the best thing about the movie, it could be the worst thing for some people, which is it plays all the hits. This movie knows what Beverly Hills Cop was. It, you know, even the opening is, you know, almost a direct rip from the opening of the original movie with a, you know, a big vehicle careening down the road and, you know, Axel Foley creating havoc and Paul Reiser stepping in for a few minutes. It's really interesting to watch a movie like this that certainly has the feel of a paint by numbers of the original, and yet the picture still looks really beautiful to me. Like, I'm still really enjoying the picture. So take that for what it's worth. I had a really good time. I thought the heart in this worked more than I expected it to. I thought the father-daughter stuff was more connective than I thought it had any right to be, and really worked. And maybe that has to do with the chemistry between them. Just seemed to work for me. And it just worked. It just worked for me. I had a good time. I was never bored and laughed quite a bit. So, yeah.
Yeah, there is something to be said for a movie that just goes back to its basics and everything, and it's not trying to go entirely to, like, let's try to retell this for a modern audience and try to relate to them and on some level. It doesn't do that. I will give it credit for that, because it does feel like this is a sequel, a lost sequel from the 80s almost, except for the age of the characters and everything. I enjoyed it enough. I was not going to make it one of my recommends, although, you know, who knows? Maybe this movie is pulling ahead of Maxine the more I think about Maxine.
You know, amazing.
You're just not, it's not one of those things. So when you watch a movie right away, you're like, okay, I like that.
Right.
And then a week later, you're like, oh, people have some good points about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been chewing over the same points.
I was just thinking about that today, actually, on the treadmill. I was thinking there is something to be said for a shift back towards rumination as opposed to instant hot takes. We are such an instant hot take culture because technology allows that to be so, and the most clout can be gained by getting your opinions out as quick as possible, that we've really lost some of the beauty of wait a couple weeks, ruminate on something, and then really deliver, you know, some fun criticism and thoughts on it. And I think we'll see a shift back to that. At least I hope so, because I really enjoy that kind of. And you do see a little bit of that on YouTube with, you know, more film essays and those kind of things happening.
There's a whole thing where somebody's like, it took me 12 years to understand this movie. And it's like a whole, like, 50-minute essay on it. I'm like, man, I totally dig that.
Totally.
So, my second small recommend is a movie that, I mean, everybody, I'm pretty sure this has been recommended either on this show or the Sincast before or whatever, but I finally got around to it. It's the Peanut Butter Falcon.
Let's go.
For some reason, this movie just had eluded me, and it may be one of those things where it's the title. You know, like, am I really going to watch this movie called Peanut Butter Falcon? Is this the thing? Uh-huh. But, But for those of you not in the know and, you know, have taken as long as I have to watch this movie, this is about a young man with Down syndrome who has, by the state of wherever they're at, it's like, I got confused with the geography in this because I think it's like North Carolina and Florida all mixed in together or whatever. But the state has decided that this man with Down syndrome must stay at an assisted living place. And he does not like that one bit. And he is being taken care of by Dakota Johnson, who I love, by the way, but just never seems to be in a great movie. This is an exception to that rule. I like her in the 50 Shades movies, but those movies are awful. But he's being taken care of by her. But then he escapes one night and he happens to jump onto a boat that is that's a Shia LaBeouf's boat, and Shia LaBeouf is running away from people who want to hurt him or even kill him for stealing their crab pots and then burning their crab pots after being confronted about it. And he goes off in his boat, and then he's like, oh no, I have a stowaway. And the whole adventure basically is that he wants to go, Shia LaBeouf wants to go to Florida, but on the way, they're going to try to stop by this old wrestler's place, the Saltwater Redneck, played by Thomas Hayden Church. He wants to go there and learn the atomic throw because he's been seeing these videotapes of the Saltwater Redneck doing this move, and he's got a course that teaches you how to do it. So the whole thing is they're going to go down to North Carolina and find this guy. And of course, meanwhile, Dakota Johnson is trying to find this person that is lost. And eventually she connects with them. And, you know, she is being told that this kid, what is his name? Cal or Kyle? I can't remember what it was. Is going to be sent to some other facility that usually like drug users and things of that nature are going to go to. So she sort of like, okay, I'm okay with this adventure then, because he doesn't need to go to a place like that. But the performances across the board here are good. Shia LaBeouf, of course, has his polarization, but he's awesome in this. And I didn't even really think about his polarization in this movie. That's how good he is. And the kid, he's actually a grown man. Zach Gottsagen is awesome in this too. And I really like this. So John Hawks is in it as well. But it's really, really good movie.
I clearly agree. I love this movie. It's one of those fun movies that just happen every year where you're like, what is this stupidly titled movie and why do I have to watch it for award season? Oh my goodness, I found one of my favorite movies. Like, it's, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really, really good and worth watching. Dakota Johnson has had a sneaky good filmography since 50 Shades. Like, El Royale is one of my favorite movies of favorite movies of all time. Peanut Butter Falcon is amazing. I don't know if you got around to seeing The Lost Daughter, Maggie Gyllenhaal's directorial debut.
I did see that.
Love that movie. She's in that and really good in that. Cha-Cha Real Smooth she's in, which is another really good one. And then just recently, Am I Okay, I think, is a really good movie too. That just came out recently. So she's picking good projects aside, you know, Write Me a Check projects. And, you know, good for her.
You know, what are you gonna think of when you think of Dakota Johnson right now? Madam Web.
Yep. That's, unfortunately, I think you are correct.
Yes. All right. We're going on to our big recommend, which is The Life Aquatic.
I love a great deal as much as the next guy, but I'm not going to crawl through a bed of hot coals just to save a few bucks. It has to be easy. No hoops, no BS. So when Mint Mobile said it was easy to get wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of a 3-month plan, I called them on it. Turns out, it's really that easy to get wireless for $15 a month. The longest part of the process was the time I spent on hold waiting to break up with my old provider. To get started, just go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. There you'll see that right now, all 3-month plans are only $15 a month, including the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Find out how easy it is to switch to Mint Mobile and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 GB on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
This is Aaron's pick, and he's going he's going to explain to us why he now, well, does he hate this movie still, or does or does he love this movie? Aaron, take it away.
Oh, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou is Wes Anderson's fourth twee journey into symmetry and recursive storytelling. Came out in 2004, made almost $35 million. No, that's not its opening weekend. That was its entire run. It currently sits with a 57% on Rotten Tomatoes, and if I had realized that before now, I'd have picked another Wes Anderson movie that I didn't get, like The Royal Tenenbaums, but life is a series of immutable choices, and we're stuck sleeping in this waterbed that I've made. We begin the movie as a Spanish movie premiere of the movie. Did I mention it was a Wes Anderson movie? Adventure number 12, The Jaguar Shark Part 1, where we're quickly introduced to aquatic explorer Steve Zissou, played by the guy from Groundhog Day, and his cast of filmmaking colleagues who all wear blue jumpsuits and a red hat on top, except for the script girl who never wears anything on top. For reasons. They have also welcomed in some unpaid interns for school credit because capitalistic corruption gets all the lols. We quickly get to the action as Klaus, who is German and also ironically the guy from Finding Nemo, can't wrap his head around the phrase Esteban was eaten. He sees Steve's case of crazy eye and gets him out of the water. We then get some Q&A where Owen Wilson asks what's next and Steve gets some unintended laughter. At the after party, we quickly meet his wife, Eleanor, played by Angelica Houston, and his rival, Alistair Hennessy, who apparently was also married to Eleanor at some point. Klaus also presents him with a crayon seahorse and an opportunity to do some stop-motion animation. At a post-movie boat party, Plimpton, the aforementioned Owen Wilson, stops him to converse in an occasional Southern accent about whether or not he should call him dad now that his mom is dead. That's right, he might be Steve Zissou's kid. Cut to a Steve Zissou talking about his boat, the Belafonte, as a curtain rises to reveal a life-size dioramic bisection of the ship with actual people moving around it. And if you listen closely, I swear you can hear Anderson orgasming in the background audio. It has a sauna, a lab, a kitchen, a library, a film studio, and a very dreamy observation bubble. Ned and Steve then do some light exposition and wine tasting, and Steve suggests Ned change his name to Kingsley Zissou before overhearing some folks talking crap about the sexual orientation of his earring. This puts him in a down mood, so as he and Ned discuss their recently deceased friends, he suggests that they fly out to his island. When they get to the island, we ponder Eleanor's backstory and how to politely tell someone that a rattlesnake throat chomped their cat. Later that night, a herd of illuminated jellyfish storm the beach for a dock shoot, and Ned's improv leads Steve to invite him to be on the crew, despite his lack of boom-holding skills. Then sudden Kate Blanchett appears as a reporter, Jane, who can be spotted as pregnant 40 feet away in the dark, and was apparently also left at the airport. Ned makes the proper arrangements and then interrupts some of Jane's prenatal reading time. Zissou then unpacks some Adidas boxes from an old sponsorship before Jane starts interviewing him with some hard-hitting questions and an accusation that his movie was as fake as the Shamu wannabe peeking in the window behind him. Klaus and Ned then share violent threats. Steve warns Ned not to trust Jane, and Steve admits that he finds the whole dad thing to be really super annoying. After Steve gets Ned his team gun, Ned wonders if the $275,000 he just inherited might help the movie keep shooting. It will, but only if they do a drug test, allow a Bond company guy on the boat, and promise not to kill the shark if they find it. We then see a hallway pan montage of the crew getting ready for the adventure. And if I'm hearing the background audio clearly, I'm quite impressed at Wes's refractory period. After Steve makes sure the lighting is right on Ned's near drowning, the crew relaxes by watching some more old Zizou clips, and Eleanor begs Steve not to leave, but he says he has to leave. So then she leaves. And it's time for the journey. Apparently, we've jumped ahead enough to be watching the rough cut of the intro to part two of the movie. Jane and Steve take a break from the interview to take a balloon ride where he investigates her interest and she continues to investigate his background. Next up, the crew break into one of Ian Malcolm's shark locator buoys to get a bead on where the shark that ate Esteban is. And under threat of the Coast Guard's arrival, they chart a course through unprotected waters despite Anne-Marie's objections. We also discovered that the only thing that could convince her to put a shirt on is apparently a need to be more directly involved in the plot. Later that night, Ned spots a second reading, so they agree to check that one out in the morning, but not before Steve can chastise him for showing him up. And a sauna meeting between Ned and Jane makes it clear that something is blooming there, and not between her and Steve. In the morning, they go check out the phantom signal, where they settle on what Ned can call Steve and avoid talking about why the fish all look like they move and are from that, like they all move from, like they're from a 60s animated Christmas special. Back in Jane's room, Ned and Jane start to consummate their budding relationship before Ned makes the confounding decision to stop making love to Kate Blanchett to tell her that someone else likes her too. Meanwhile, as our serenading guitar player plays a Portuguese version of Bowie, some pirates invade the ship, kidnap Ned, but take the Bond Company guy instead later because he conveniently speaks Filipino. And in what must be a dream sequence, Steve chews through his ropes and single-handedly diehards the pirates off the boat. And nope, I think this is actually supposed to be reality. While performing a funeral, Hennessy shows up to help so they cover up any sign that they stole from him, mostly because he's a dog-swatting jerk face, probably. The crew is now suffering from low morale, so Steve doesn't not lay out a non-confusing quitting protocol in which some of them decide to leave. Jane, the reporter, also decides to leave despite Ned's lovesick wishes. Steve drops off the quitters and then goes landside to see if Eleanor will loan him some more money to save the Bond Company hostage and finish the story. Back on the boat, Steve invades yet another Jane and Ned cuddle session because apparently she's decided to stay now and finish the story. And the movie thinks this non-love triangle must be pretty interesting because Ned and Steve continue talking about it for the next 5 minutes. I mean, they do eventually throw a punch at each other before Jane joins them to blow some bubblegum bubbles and hover as Ned uncovers some more backstory that is as confusing as it is clarifying. Eleanor then shows up to lead the rescue of the Bond Company guy and uses his Whistler powers, no, not the blade ones, the sneaker ones, to identify the island where they will go to do the rescue. Some more assembly cut exposition reveals that a Hennessy boat has been sunk around the island and that they're ready, the same island that they're ready to invade. So invade they do. After some swamp leeches with a very specific palate and some nostalgia about the abandoned hotel's former bartender skills, they finally ascend several staircases so that Klaus can pout a bit about not getting picked for a squad. But it's all for naught as they apparently picked the wrong Ping Island. Steve falls down the stairs, mostly so the movie can have another father-son non-sentimental conversation between Papa Steve and Kingsley. But wait, Klaus heard something in the closet, and it's the Bond Company guy. The dog has also sniffed something out, and it's the pirates playing cards with the guy from The Fly. Steve decides to engage, and as the pirates return a volley of ineffectual fire, I'm convinced that this is the part of the movie that all the stormtroopers watch and laugh and laugh and laugh. It's funny because it's true, they say between gasps for air. Also, the assholes that left the dog on the... Also, these assholes leave the dog on the island if for no other reason than to inspire Wes to make a movie about it 14 years later.
Yep.
Ned convinces Steve to continue after the jaguar shark if for no other reason than to have some more father-son sentimental moments and to try and resolve the Klaus storyline satisfactorily. After that's out of the way, the POS helicopter falls apart and Steve and Ned crash into the ocean just as they spot signs of the shark. Steve then drags Ned's corpse all the way to shore, somehow all the way to shore somehow so that there could be an emotional funeral where everyone can mourn, including some random members of Ned's Air Kentucky crew. It's worth it, though, because Eleanor finally cries in front of Steve, Jane's story gets the cover slot, and Alistair finally resolves an important subplot about what percentage of him is gay. With just a few minutes left in the movie, the jaguar shark is spotted again, so the guy from What About Bob blows every single person into his yellow submarine to dive through some sea life that looks shockingly like the sockfish the guy in Hundreds of Beavers caught with his bloody fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, they all find the bioluminescent jaguar shark, and struck by its beauty, they all lay hands on an emotional Steve before we cut back to the end of the movie screening at the same theater with an empty seat where Steve should be. Instead, he's out smoking on the red carpet with his award. A small boy comes out and he hands him a Zizou Society Junior member ring, thus perpetuating the never-ending cycle of water and death. Or at least that's what I assume the movie is saying. All that's left is for a cast walk through the credits, where Jeff Goldblum magically appears in the long shot despite never joining the parade, and a missed opportunity to end this movie with the word Finn. Chris,
only you would think of that as an unfitting end. They didn't put Finn at the end. What the hell?
Come on, guys. Did you think this time through the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou?
As some people will realize in the outtakes, my only real watch of this movie was out of order. But I'll leave that for the outtakes for you guys to hear that story. But I was meh about this movie. Like, I didn't hate it, didn't love it, obviously. This is the movie where Wes Anderson, I think, truly does start having his head up his own ass. Like he's got that success of Rushmore and Royal Tannenbaums under his belt now, and to a lesser extent Bottle Rocket, if anybody's seen that. But it feels like now he's like, oh, I'm going to let these scenes hang with that Wes Anderson, like, especially the beginning of this movie. It's almost insufferable how he holds on to jokes like they're the funniest things ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the pacing of that opening is so off that I'm just like, dude, get on with it, please. You are not as amusing as you think you are in this moment. And so I went through this and I decided, go through what I liked about it. And there's a few things. I do like Owen Wilson's character a decent amount, even though I think from what I'm reading from your reading of the plot, you don't really care about this Bill Murray thing with him. I don't.
It's interesting. It's hard in a Wes Anderson movie to care because everything seems so Sunday school felt board, you know what I mean? Like it's hard to like connect to them as real people, in some ways, but I, whether I cared about it or not, I felt it was overdone.
It was definitely that. But I like his character because he is very sweet and unassuming and all this other stuff. But when Willem Dafoe comes over and confronts him, later, and then later he turns around and Owen Wilson turns right around and says, "You ever put your hands on me again, I'm going to beat you up," or whatever he says. I'm like, oh yeah. And he does that several times throughout the movie. And it was like, he's kind of sweet, but he's not a pushover. And I really did like that about him. That's about the only thing though, that I really liked there. I actually did love that pirate sequence, even though it's kind of out of character for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some like other things about Bill Murray being in this movie too, but, it's one moment in this movie that I'm like, man, that is insane. And I can get on board with it. It feels like it's a different movie though. And that's fine. It's like, if you had made a movie based kind of around this more, then I would have been more on board with the movie. But you seem to have this family dynamic thing that's not working in mind as the bulk of the movie. And so it's weird to like something that's out of place in the movie, but that's one moment that actually gave me some smiles. And that that Bond stooge guy in general, anything involving him, I thought was pretty funny. Like, especially when Bill Murray is openly saying, you know, we got good this Bond stooge or whatever, and he goes, that really hurt. I'm a human being, you know. Uh-huh. Oh yeah, I'm sorry about that. I also like the part when the movie is showing the process of shooting the film. They're obviously not completely 100% real. You know, they show a clip in there where they're all out swimming and having a good time, and he goes, oh, is that the sound of an animal that might be hurt in the back? And of course, you know, he's not actually hearing this. That's just something that cutting to or whatever. It's kind of a, if I'm reading into it correctly, it's kind of that Nanook of the North type of thing, that old silent film where it was very well critically acclaimed, but the filmmaker very famously staged a lot of things in the movie so that you would be like, oh wow, this is amazing that he captured all this stuff. And I'm sure a lot of documentaries do that, but that's the thing that came to my mind. But so I like that, all that stuff. When they're talking about the process of making these short films, I wish the movie had centered on that more than on the other stuff, because that's where Wes Anderson really shines, I think, is looking at the absurdity of especially an independent film crew trying to shoot something, that's dangerous on the water or like out in the wild or anything like that. That really appealed to me. I really like the Willem Dafoe character. I just generally love Willem Dafoe. And the Seu Jorge stuff all the way through, the David Bowie covers are all fantastic as we go to the movie. The stuff I didn't like, Angelica Houston has an awesome character that the plot decides you don't need to be in this movie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't understand why you would. This is one of those things where it feels like you write something and you're like this character, nobody likes this character, so I'll just send them off for a while. And then Angelica Houston comes in here and smokes it. And then you didn't realize what you had when you started making the movie. And so like, I thought it was, I mean, her character is the one that I thought it was awesome when she got back into the movie. I'm like, she could have just been, I guess if she's not in the movie, they don't get to do the crazy shit that they want to do. But it disappointed me that such a good character got kicked out early on. I feel like Bill Murray is miscast in this movie. I don't know what it is about it. As a fraudster, we totally believe Bill Murray, because Bill Murray plays fraudsters very well. As an adventurer, as someone who wants to go out there and do all these type of things, could not buy Bill Murray in that role. And I feel like somebody else could have been in this that could have really sold, especially the family drama and all that. Although who knows, it may not even be on the written page. Something that will make me care about him and his possible son and his divorce and all this other stuff. But I kept thinking that Willem Dafoe would be a better adventurer than Bill Murray. And Bill Murray's not doing Bill Murray things, really. Bill Murray's in the middle of a kind of a phase of his career where he's kind of looking for an Oscar, maybe. You know, it starts off with Rushmore, and then he goes on into like Lost in Translation. And he's in this period of time where he's playing kind of serious stuff, even though there's a little comedy in it and everything. This just didn't work for me at all. I feel like somebody else should have been in this role as Steve Zissou.
I had the same thought, and mm-hmm. even like thought of other people. I thought George Clooney might have been interesting in that role. But I landed on Paul Newman. I just thought, what an interest. Especially,
oh my God, Paul Newman would be amazing.
Especially with what this movie is trying to say about, like, not just fathers and sons, but like mentors, like, you know, the Klaus stuff. And like, it's clearly about passing on legacy and mentorship and those kind of things. Like, man, I just feel like he would have been really, really interesting. I don't know if he'd ever done something like a Wes Anderson movie, but I think he could have hit the comedy as well as the gravitas.
Oh, but he definitely would have. I mean, we look at his performance in Hudsucker Proxy. I think that tells you everything that you need to know about this. So, yeah, I think Paul Newman would be I think George Clooney would have been perfect. He may not have been old enough at this point to play somebody who's done decades of these independent films, but Bill Murray just doesn't fit here. I think in general, aside from the harassment of women that we know about Bill Murray at this point and everything, people generally like Bill Murray in 2004, and we're like, oh, he can do anything. And this is not him. This is not him at all. That animated wildlife is super weird to me. I don't understand.
So weird.
I don't understand it. Henry Selick was the guy in charge of that, and Henry Selick is very talented. But that, talk about being in a different movie.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you see the wildlife in this movie, and it's just a bunch of sprites on screen, it really distracts from anything else that they want to do in this. And I know there's probably a comment in here about, well, everything's fake anyway, so why don't we just go all, why don't we just go all in on that? And it's like, you take a viewer out on that. And then the final thing, I've already said this before, but I didn't really connect to the Bill Murray Owen Wilson relationship. There doesn't appear to be anything in Zissou's life that says this guy needs a potential son he may or may not bond with. And I also didn't really care for the Kate Blanchett and Owen Wilson relationship or any of the relationship drama that they threw in this. That's a big, huge chunk of the movie. So yeah, that's what I come down to. Meh, there's some good moments in it, and that's about it.
This increased my respect for this movie. I didn't like this movie at all. In fact, I went through Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic, and Darjeeling Limited, bang, 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 going, oh, I guess Wes Anderson isn't for me, because I downright hated Darjeeling. I was so annoyed during that entire movie. And so this is right in the center of that. Watching it back again, and I think it has a lot to do with how Wes Anderson's career has evolved to become more Wes Anderson-y. Like, he is, you talk about him being up his own butt or whatever, and that the positive way you could say that is he's finding himself. Like, he's finding who he truly wants to be. And I think both things are true, by the way, and worth that those narratives, I think, are both true. But for me, watching specifically French Dispatch and then the one that just Asteroid City, and you go, oh, this is what you always wanted to be. And you start to see how in these early movies, like, he's almost fighting against himself in some ways. Like, you mentioned the wildlife and those creatures and that kind of stuff. It's not just that they're weird and they feel out of place. It's that the movie isn't committing to that, right? Like, it's wanting to feel one way for a lot of it, and then a weird marionette play for the other part. And Wes Anderson, I think at his heart, just wants to be the marionette play. That's what he wants to be. He doesn't want you to come to his movies expecting reality. He wants you to come to his movies expecting stories told in a unique way. And I think he's just finding his groove with that more and more. And because of that, I was able to watch this and go, oh, I kind of see what you're doing here more than I think the first time, I watched it, which gives me a little bit more chance to sink into some of the subtle humor and the ironically dry humor of this movie, and to have a better time with it. I still don't love this movie. I think it is messy precisely because it is half and half. It is half like Wes Anderson, core, and half, populist attempt at movie making. And I just don't know that it always works together perfectly. A few specific things to say. Number one, I just noticed this time going through this that the poster is much darker and much more interesting than I realized, because Owen Wilson is in the yellow sub with him. Is that his ghost? Like, that is after he dies.
Hey, I want to do the spoiler alert on the poster now.
that's right. So I thought that was funny. I was like, oh, Owen Wilson's ghost is in the poster.
I mean, honestly, I don't understand why they chose the yellow sub as their poster thing. Maybe that's what they thought was cool or whatever. But
yeah,
It should have been probably on the ship itself, or some other kind of artwork.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've come to love about Wes Anderson is his creative use of exposition. And that's why I think a lot of times his movies are, you know, plays within books, within movies, within magazine articles, because it's a fun way for him to be able to do narration or exposition or different things that are usually probably in his mind, in many of our minds, you know, the typical lazy, boring way to do things. Mm-hmm. And he finds a fun way to make it interesting. A character can stand and deliver to an audience if it's a play, right?
Yeah.
That's interesting. It can be poetic and artistic if it's an article from a magazine. And so, you know, like to bring that stuff to life is interesting. And you see the seeds of that here with the actual movie making that they're doing. And it's really fun for him to kind of see him discover that in this movie a little bit. So I liked that.
He kind of does it with Rushmore a little bit.
Sure.
I don't think he's found that as a, I'm going to start a lot of my movies this way type of thing. But after this, I don't know if Darjeeling does this, but like a lot of movies do this though, where he starts off with somebody talking straight to the camera about what you're about to see. Asteroid mm-hmm. City was huge on that, of course.
Yep.
But that is a fun thing that he does.
And as mentioned, I was able to enjoy some of the subtle humor a little bit more. There's a moment, and it's the only one I'll bring up. There's so many moments like this, but Steve asks Anne-Marie if the interns get Glocks. He's like, hey, Anne-Marie, do the interns get Glocks? And her response is, no, they all share one, which is just one of the funniest things I've ever heard. Like, it just... I don't know. There's a lot of this movie that made me laugh this time through, that I was more relaxed into it. And so I was able to kind of vibe with some of the humor better. Yeah. So I thought that was really, really funny. And then I would just say I'm all for Wes Anderson evolution. I'm on record as loving his recent stuff. And the short films that he just did, I thought were mm-hmm. all great. And again, another example of what he sees filmmaking, you know, how he sees that artistic process to be. And I will take it over every franchise remake ever. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I love somebody who's out there doing interesting, fun stuff. And I found it very enjoyable to watch his ascension, his evolution to his final form, which is really fun. So, yeah.
I don't know if we talked about, we may have in the year end, thing, but The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar that I think won best short film, didn't it?
I believe so.
I really enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun, and I've liked a lot of his latter day stuff too. There's maybe a couple in there that didn't hit quite right for me. It's funny, right after you talk about, you know, the string here of Royal Tannenbaums and Life Aquatic and Darjeeling Limited, he goes into Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is the start of like an incredible run.
I agree.
After that.
Yeah.
By the time Fantastic Mr. Fox came out, I was like, oh man, I hope this isn't like another one in a row that I don't like, whatever. But Fantastic Mr. Fox was just a huge return to form. So, anyway.
And I guess I would expand a little bit on what I mentioned earlier about mentors, because it is something I didn't pick up on with this movie the first time through, but really locked in for me at the end where the little boy comes out, and I realized, oh, this isn't just about fathers and sons. It's about the idea of mentorship, the idea of doing interesting things, pursuing passions, and then passing them on and leading others you know, to those passions. And it's clear there is both some respect and some good-natured, you know, jabbing of the Jacques Cousteau, you know, kind of thing. And in this movie, I think honors in many ways the idea that, you know, people who try to do great things are passing on positive things to, you know, the next generation, whether it be a son you didn't know you had, a crew member that really looks up to you, the Klaus character, or, you know, a little boy who just saw, you know, the second part of your movie or whatever. So I found that really connective this time in a way that I didn't notice the first time. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, on to the super secret double feature for this movie.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I was trying to think of a whole bunch of type. It seemed like every time I landed on something at the beginning, it was another Wes Anderson movie, because a lot of Wes Anderson movies had this kind of thing where somebody is kind of in over their head, and but yet they still exude like they're an expert, and that's sort of a lot of his characters and everything. But I didn't have to go too much further to find the double feature here. I'm going to go with Broken Flowers, which is another Bill Murray movie. This is one he did with Jim Jarmusch. And it has kind of some of the same things in it. In this movie, he is told by someone he used to date that he has a 19-year-old kid, and he doesn't know who sent him the letter because it's anonymous. So he spends the whole movie finding old lovers and, of course, conjuring up all sorts of different things that he didn't expect. And meanwhile, by the way, Jeffrey Wright is fantastic in this movie. He's always fantastic, of course. But he's like a detective trying to figure out things for Bill Murray in this movie. But the whole thing is him going to, you know, find these old lovers and trying to figure out if they know anything about this 19-year-old kid. So sort of fitting into the line of what he's going through in this movie. And this is a period of Bill Murray. Like I said, it seems like he's really trying to get that stamp, that seal of approval on his career by the end of this. Like, there's a 6 or 7 year period where it seems like he's really going for that Oscar. So this is one of them, but he's great in this. And this movie is I think pretty good. I don't remember it being great, but it's pretty good if I remember correctly. So that's would be a good double feature with this one.
I need to check this out. I've never seen this. And I vaguely remember it. Especially when I've heard people talk about, Jarmusch and his movies, and the cast is, wow, Sharon Stone, yeah. Tilda Swinton, Julie Delpy, you mentioned Jeffrey Wright, Jessica Lange, Chloe Sevigny, and Christopher McDonald is in this. I love Christopher McDonald. It's what a cast. I definitely need to check this out.
This Bill Murray's great in this, but this is Jeffrey Wright's movie. When you watch it, it's just everything about him is like, oh, it's such a welcome breath of fresh air when he comes up on screen. So,
nice.
It'll be, very I cool. think, I think you will, might enjoy this. Nice. All right. Continuing with the theme, that Castroff said, we have such a great and zingy, title for this movies that we were recommended or don't like. What do you call this anyway? I've changed my mind, or what do you call it? What would you call
reconsideration?
This? Let's do a reconsideration. There we go. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the zippy title that we need.
There we go.
Do we need a title? I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to continue this next week with a movie that it seemed like everybody in my circle loved, maybe not everybody. I think along the CinemaSins crew, maybe this movie was a little divisive, but I don't like Joker 2019, and it has a very high IMDb rating, and it was like nominated for millions of Oscars, and it's about to get a sequel this year. I am going to revisit this movie, and I hope that I can get on board with it, but every time I think about everything in this movie, I'm like, how are you going to turn me around on this? However, I do love this process, and I will give anything a chance, a second or third chance. If speaking of, like Blade Runner, I gave that a million chances. So looking forward to going back into this and seeing if there's anything about it that maybe I missed last time. What do you think about this movie?
I will be on that journey with you. I didn't like this movie much at all. I have another movie podcast I do. My co-host on that podcast loves this movie, absolutely loves it. And so I probably owe it a rewatch. I've only seen it the once. There was nothing about this movie that made me go, I want to see that again. My short review, my Letterboxd, you know, style review, it was basically, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is an incredible actor, even in terrible movies like this one. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, he's of course astonishing in this, but it doesn't make the movie make sense or be valuable or, you know, whatever. So, but yeah, I'd love to give it a second chance.
I mean, the people who the apologists for this movie are like, they're strong on how like how much they like this movie.
Sure.
And they tell me all the reasons and I'm like, okay. Can't get on board with you, but I'm going to give this another chance. I'm going to get another chance. By the way, Josh and James both came up with Recco-sideration and Recco-sidertopia. Are those snappy enough for you, Castroff? Are they? I'm calling you out by name. Are they snappy enough for you?
Amazing.
Anyway, maybe room for one question?
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
I'm going to go with the food. We needed to get this one cleared off the board. So what is your favorite movie food you know you can never have?
All right. Favorite movie food you know you can never have. It's gotta be from the Wonkaverse for me. Like, you know, like it was one of those questions when I first read it was like, okay, I know the universe that I'm going with. And then it was a list of 100 different choices, you know, because there's so many interesting candies and stuff. I landed on from the new Wonka movie, there's a chocolate that are like Broadway chocolates, and when you eat them, everything you say turns into a Broadway song. And that to me just sounds like heaven. Yes, I know it would be hell for most or some, I don't know. But for me, that just sounds amazing. So to speak in Broadway musical form would be wonderful. So I went with those.
Yeah, talk about a movie I might need to give another chance someday. Is that Wonka?
I did love Wonka. I did love it.
Yeah. Mine is very easy. I know they don't make it sound tasty or anything, but for some reason, in these movies, I was always like, yeah, I want to try that. The Lembas bread from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it's a good choice.
Yeah. Wanted to try that out because, isn't it supposed to be like amazingly filling and all that and whatever, but every time they said they were going to eat some Lembas bread, I was like, okay, I want to try that. It probably tastes like regular bread, but because it says Lembas, it makes me want to eat it more for some reason. I don't know what that is. But anyway, going over to the chat, Josh says, Soylent Green? Yeah, I mean, it's made of people. So.
It's got to be good.
Slab says that burger from the menu, been chasing that burger for 6 months, still can't find one that tastes as good as that one looks. Man, I tell you what, we used to have a place here called Rotiers that had a burger that I still dream about, and that place closed.
Best burger you've ever had?
Yep, best burger I've ever had.
I think the best burger I've ever had is probably the what's the Shake Shack. Shake Shack does a great burger, and it reminds me of that kind of smash burger like you see on in the menu. I guess Smashburger is another burger place. But Shake Shack has an incredible burger. So
yeah. Castro says the Turkish Delight from Narnia.
That's the right answer. That's so good.
Yeah, I bet that is good actually. Tatsu says a Cuban from Chef. Talk about Chef. You cannot watch Chef without not getting hungry for every
I want that
item.
Grilled cheese. I want that grilled cheese so bad when he's making that grilled cheese.
Oh my God. You're talking about Wes Anderson having an orgasm behind the screen. I'm having one on screen right now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Next week is Joker. God, I hope it's a good experience this time. I'm not expecting it. But anyway, we'll see you next time, guys. Thank you, chat.
See ya. Well,
see ya.
Bye.
Bye. part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. This movie, by the way, Life Aquatic, brings back one particular memory working at the Hollywood 27.
Okay.
So we got this print for a critic screening. We didn't get very many critic screenings because it was usually the Green Hills Theater that got the critic screenings. Occasionally we'd get them, though. And a couple of us were really excited about getting this movie because we liked all the other Wes Anderson stuff.
Yeah.
And everything.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
So the print for this movie, I can't remember exactly the details of why this happened, but it wasn't going to come in until like 2 hours before the movie actually ran for critics.
Wow.
And you had to build movies. So
right.
Everybody to realize this is the prehistoric, pre-digital era where you had to build with reels. And I wasn't there that day. I was going to go in to watch the screening of the movie just before my shift that night. I believe right. That's how I was going about it. But they either because of piracy concerns, which they were way too overboard about piracy concerns. On these movies, or it was because it was coming from some other theater and they couldn't get it there until 2 hours before the screen time. That's the circumstances which happened. So we go in to go watch this critical screening of it, sitting there watching it, and I guess we'd gone through 3 reels. And I have worked in movie theaters at this point for 11 years. I've worked in projection for 9.
Okay.
I had never experienced this before. There was, I distinctly remember hearing the sound. And you remember, you know, the music that's in this movie, that or whatever. You could hear that come in over the soundtrack as the reel changed. And it went to the next reel. And then this guy who I know is a critic at this one, weekly newspaper. And he is, works at the Bell Court as a box office cashier. He stood up and he's like, "The movie's out of order." And he walked out. And I was like, "Oh fuck." As the head projectionist of this theater, I was like, "Oh no. What?" And I was like, is he right? And I was like, I think he is right, because I've never seen that before in my life. As long as I had been working projection, I had never seen that error before. And it was pretty simple to explain why that happened. It's because when the movie arrived, I asked the guy who built it. He was like, "Man, there wasn't any, they had put the head," like, some quick projectioneering here. Most projection booths, when they would build movies, each reel comes with a head and a tail, and the head of the movie is what you need to put on first. But one thing that they do is they cut off a reference frame on the heads and tails,
right,
so that you know that this is the head. This head matches this part of the reel, and that's that. Well, what apparently whoever had built this movie before in a previous screening did not cut off reference frames, and the heads and tails were all mixed. So you had to kind of like guess a little bit about where the reels were because everything was messed up like that.
Right.
And so I was like, "Oh my God, see," and this is all because of just really, honestly, some way overblown stuff about piracy and things that was going on at the time. That's around the time that they start. It wasn't until a year or two later they started putting locks on film cans.
Mm.
Well, like the first one I remember, I think it was Iron Man that did that. There may have been some others before that.
Okay.
But I remember it was your God-given right as a movie theater worker, especially a projectionist, to watch a movie and make sure it was good before it went out to the public.
Yep.
And they were doing this thing with like, you know, we're going to put padlocks on so you can't screen it and can't put it on the internet later. Like a lot of people are fucking watching movies that way. Like, I know it's enough to be like, that's annoying. We didn't get our extra million that we would have gotten or whatever. But I remember, I think it was Iron Man that because they come with 4-digit padlocks. I one night, because I had nothing else to do, 0001, 0002, 0003. And I finally got to the number at like 6274 or whatever it was.
You went through 6,200 or in some like permutations?
What can I say, man? I had nothing but time.
That's amazing.
I mean, you're talking about, this is not, you know, this is not like, it's time consuming, yes, but it's not like as time consuming as it sounds, because you're doing 1, 2, 3, and it's, and you're counting at a, I think it probably took me about 2 hours or so to get that thing over.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I'm trying to think how long 62,000 seconds is, right? You divide that by 60, is that right? So that's,
it'd be 6,200.
Yeah, right. So 6,200, you do one a second, so 6,200 mm-hmm. seconds. So it'd be times 60 for minutes, right?
Yeah.
200 times 60. No, I'm doing this wrong.
So I guess you would say 60 times 60 for the amount of seconds in an hour, and then you would divide that number into the 6,000 something, whatever. Yeah. So you're talking about 3,600 seconds probably, and then divide that by, yeah. So it was 2 hours. It was about 2 hours.
About 2 hours.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
About right.
That's wild, man.
And I mean, you got to go and you got to start movies and you got to make sure everything's good, but I didn't have anything to build. I didn't have anything else to do other than start movies.
I don't know if you're dealing with statute of limitations on, unlocking a movie you weren't supposed to unlock or anything, but, did you end up watching it early then since you got it unlocked? Heck yeah.
That's the whole reason. No. Yeah. That I highly, highly doubt that, it's Paramount that did Iron Man back in the day.
Is going to be
like, hey, you watched that movie early.
That'd be amazing if the answer to Paramount's financial troubles that we're hearing so much about in the news is they're coming after Chris Atkinson. They're like, we are suing this man for cracking the code. Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, even before you started talking about the locks and stuff, that it has to be so... not just frustrating, but also anxiety inducing not to be able to screen, you know, a print before you put it up for, like, to have to just build it and get it in front of people, to not be able to go to catch your own mistakes. Like,
yeah, well, and that's the thing, man. I don't want to make it sound like piracy isn't a real issue. I just think they went overboard on how they, people are going to pirate the movies. It's just the way it was going to be. Mm-hmm. There's no real way to police that. I mean, yeah, you could strangle the amount of chances someone could pirate something, but people would still pirate it. But like, this happened a couple of times. I remember when Revenge of the Sith came out, we had, I think it was like 7 or 8 prints of that movie. And, you know, the big deal was to get people to watch these prints so that, you know, they could tell us, hey, was there anything messed up or whatever. And I think the one that I ended up on, one of those 7 or 8 prints, on the last reel, this is during the whole, you know, have the high ground and all that bullshit. The sound was going, it was like there was the discoloration that kept going in and out, and like the sound kept on going in and out. Like, one of the frequent problems that you'd have with movies is that on your digital track, sometimes the digital track would lapse out. It wouldn't be printed correctly or something like that. So you'd get this thing where it would go to spectral recording, which was just a regular stereo thing. And then it would go to SRD, which is Dolby Digital. And it would go back and forth like that. throughout that. That's what this reel was doing. And this was the day before this is supposed to come out. And this is, you know, I have to call somebody about this and say, I need a new reel. And then they, you have to get somebody who's on the line who's like, okay, I get you, pal, but this is a big movie and everything. Yeah, it is a huge movie. That's why I'm calling you about this reel, and that maybe perhaps, I know that you're not the one in power, maybe perhaps we should get these prints way earlier so that this is not an issue for you night before the opening.
Yeah.
You know, so that happened a lot. And I'm sure I've gone over it before, and I'll talk about it some other time, but the digital conversion to Hollywood 27 was one of the biggest, oh my God, insane things they have ever done. Did it on the week of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. I will never forgive Regal for this. And so there you go. Inside baseball to the projectionist room.